Whenever I get a request from a college student for a meeting with the minister, I try to expedite the scheduling. Often it's Tuesday and they have a paper due on Thursday, and unbeknownst to me, they've already decided that I am the subject of their interview. Having been a student for far too many years, I sympathize. Nothing focuses the mind quite like a deadline. Usually it's a paper they have due for an elective course in religion, and they remain vague on the details of the assignment, apart from find a religion you know almost nothing about yourself. Ours is a religion that many people know almost nothing about themselves, as you may have surmised from your own experiences over the years attempting to explain it. So it was that I wound up meeting with a student from a local college in my office one recent Wednesday afternoon. We'll call the student Andy. Andy had done some pretty cursory research on this congregation in our spiritual tradition because, as he told me, he wanted the information to come to him fresh. Subsequently, a lot of what I told him proved startling or confusing, but there's no doubt that Andy was an eager learner in that full hour we had together. We started out discussing the beliefs that Unitarian Universalists commonly hold, but he quickly picked up another line of inquiry and began asking me how I decided to become a UU minister, and then, following his own curiosity, he wanted to know what sort of faith life I had had in college. Before too long, we were discussing what sort of faith Andy has presently and what sort of faith life he wants for himself, because the two are not one and the same. He has a savvy sense that the faith of his childhood will not serve as the faith of his adulthood, and we had a frank conversation in which I normalized that development for him. Young adulthood is frequently a stage filled with spiritual seeking. His experience mirrored mine and numerous others. I recommended a book written by one of my colleagues who worked for decades as a university chaplain and a handful of other titles because, like any good UU, I believe in illumination through bibliography. I also suggested that he read a few different essays by Ralph Waldo Emerson. During my senior year in college, Emerson essentially blew the lid off all my earlier youthful thinking. I don't know how else to describe his work other than revelatory. His writing occasioned a spiritual awakening that left me with a restless soul that my 20-something self felt at a loss to direct. In a fitting twist, I should add, I encountered Emerson in my elective course in religion. When I read his classic piece, The Oversoul, I understood that the purpose of my education had immediately altered. Let us learn the revelation of all nature and thought that the highest dwells within us, Emerson wrote, that the sources of nature are in our own minds. The soul's health consists in the fullness of his reception, he declared. I became conscious of my human existence in an entirely new way in my early 20s. By the time our class made its autumnal field trip to Concord, Massachusetts, Emerson had made a transcendentalist out of me, and I was a convert arriving on the shores of Walden Pond on a personal pilgrimage. According to Emerson, humanity is a stream whose source is hidden. Our being is descended into us from we know not whence. I see that I am but a surprised spectator of this ethereal water, he observed. By the same fire, vital, consecrating, celestial, which burns until it shall dissolve all things into waves and surges of an ocean of light, we see and know each other. We are all discerners of spirit, he concluded. By becoming discerning in this way, we come to consciousness about a primary purpose of ours, to link ourselves with the global consciousness of all in the Oversoul. Emerson was a graduate of Harvard Divinity School, tutored in the Christian tradition, fluent in Latin and Greek. But after he resigned from Unitarian ministry over a doctrinal dispute with his congregation, the Sage of Concord, as he was famously called, studied wisdom writings from other world religions. The insights of Hindu mystics and Vedantic philosophers reached Emerson through translation that somehow resonated millennia later and half a world away. How could such different thinkers possibly hold truths in common? We live in succession and division in parts and particles, Emerson explained. Meantime, within each is the soul of the whole, the wise silence, the universal beauty, to which every part and particle is equally related, the eternal one. The reality that Emerson is describing resembles one that quantum physicists have begun mapping for general audiences, and that science fiction writers have made the subject of several popular novels. In his book, At the Edge of Uncertainty, American physicist Michael Brooks writes, "Just as the tides ebb and flow created the perfect conditions for life to arise at the edge of Earth's oceans, the place where certainty gives rise to uncertainty, the shoreline of our ignorance is fertile ground indeed." Dr. Brooks quotes the Nobel Prize-winning scientist Richard Feynman as saying, "Everything we know is only some kind of approximation. Therefore, things must be learned only to be unlearned again, or more likely, to be corrected." Learning and unlearning happens as a part of a singular human cycle throughout our lifespans. Owning the ability we have to change our minds, or perhaps to have our minds changed, is the beginning of ageless wisdom. In the end, what's considered New Age thought can sound very ancient, and what's considered very ancient appears to anticipate quantum physics, and everything old is suddenly new again. We seem to have forgotten profound truths about who we are in this universe we inhabit. Could there be a cosmic consciousness? Can we intuit it? Perhaps we have been eating grass for too long, but it turns out that we, much like the youthful hero in our Hindu parable this morning, are tigers. Surprise. We are all tigers here. We have impulses that we may never fully comprehend, that set us off on quests we may never actually conclude. Whatever schedule our learning happens on, we ought to remain existential explorers throughout our lives. What do we know exactly? How do we know it? Why do we know it? Are we sure we know? Our answers may surprise even ourselves. Thoughts come into our minds by avenues which we never left open, and thoughts go out of our minds through avenues which we never voluntarily opened, Emerson noted. When we become receptive to revelation, or better yet, prone toward it, we start to take a religious view on matters small, large, and everywhere in between. The Reverend Dr. Marnie Philippe Harmony tells us that we have to go down to the wave's trough to find ourselves and then ride her swell until we can see beyond ourselves into our neighbor's eye. We have got to walk the waves as well as solid ground. We need to recapture the broadest strokes of life in order to live consciously. Our spiritual journeys happen not only on solid ground, but in the air and also over the waters. An oceanic awareness that allows for the unity of wave and sea alike helps us to understand the proverbial waters we swim in and makes us stronger swimmers too, better able to navigate the particulars of our individual existences with some sense of wider perspective. We do not yet possess ourselves, and we know at the same time that we are much more, we are wiser than we know, Emerson maintained. With each divine impulse, the mind comes out into eternity. It converses with truths that have been spoken in the world and becomes conscious of a closer sympathy. The soul is superior to its knowledge, wiser than any of its works. In Emerson's estimation, the heart in any one of us is essentially the heart of all. Not a valve, not a wall, not an intersection there is anywhere in nature, but one blood rolls uninterruptedly in an endless circulation through all, as the waters of the globe is all one sea, and truly seen, its tide is one. It is one, and we are one, consequently. Because we share a heart, Emerson explained, we also share a mind. The mind is one, and the best minds who love truth for its own sake think much less of property and truth. They thankfully accept it everywhere. These eager minds accept universal truths in congregations and classrooms and meaningful conversations where our biggest questions are engaged openly and with a measure of awe. So much is in our field of awareness these days that our consciousness, divine consciousness, is in routine danger of getting crowded out, and we risk losing sight of what we know, and also what we know that we do not know. When we are self-conscious in the truest sense of the term, we attend to our own internal imperatives as well as all the external stimuli flooding us. We lie open, Emerson contended, to the deeps of spiritual nature, to the attributes of God. Curiosity is key in our ongoing spiritual formation. It supports the evolution of our souls. We need to stay curious always. I'm eternally grateful to earnest students like Andy who remind me of this. Even if you are done with your required and elective courses, even if you finished a long time ago now and have no more papers to write, life can present us with endless learning opportunities. In case any of you are wondering, yes, the sermon this morning was written on a March 1st deadline. My assignment came from Hugh Wellesley Hills member Ann Stoner, our auction winner last year, who wanted me to consider the question, what is consciousness? I have considered that, but obviously not answered it to any conclusive degree. So I ask you all, what is consciousness? And are you certain about that?